On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'm Corey Johnson from Bloomberg West. I do a daily TV show called Bloomberg West and Bloomberg Radio, which is actually now live in San Francisco as of today. So I'm the dulcet tones are broadcast all over the Bay Area right now. But I'm beyond excited to talk to Eric today because I'm a huge fan of his work. So when I got the call to do this, I was just, it couldn't happen fast enough. And I'm a little bit about Eric. Some of you know his work, but Eric Schlosser talks about a lot of subjects that the mainstream media tends to ignore. Over the years, he's followed the harvest with migrant farm workers in California, spent time with meatpacking workers in Texas and Colorado, and some harrowing stories. So the victims of violent crime told their stories and visited prisons throughout the United States. And shedding light on those worlds that are often hidden, his book, Fast Food Nation, is a sort of a well-known, documented moment that captures what's really going on in the food that we eat and that America eats, and really helped to start a revolution in how people think about what they eat. I am often giving away copies of Reefer Madness. I mean, Eric, I mean, the commissions I've generated for you are massive. I've given away, because I refer to Reefer Madness as one of the best business books I've ever read, just a wonderful collection of the stories of this underground economies in America. In Command and Control now, the third book here since Fast Food Nation, finalist for the Pulitzer Prize last year, the Pulitzer Prize in History. And before writing these wonderful nonfiction works, Eric was a playwright and worked for an independent film company. He's recently returned to some of those fields. But now to talk about the state of the nuclear arsenal and how it's not just all tech. It's a great topic for those of us in the Bay Area and thinking about Silicon Valley and the infallibility of technology. What better tells that story than the history of the nuclear arsenal and its fallibility. Join me in welcoming Eric Schlosser.
Thank you. Thank you.
I put off reading the book for a while because it seemed like so much, but your books are so wonderfully readable, no more so than this book. And I thought we'd start by, I'm just going to ask you to tell me some of the stories that are in the book, and then we'll move beyond that. And I also want to encourage people to give us some questions, and we'll take some questions as well. As you think about them, please write them as plainly and short, briefly as possible. But Eric, you describe really with great detail what happens when a nuclear bomb goes off.
Heat hotter than the center of the sun is created, and an explosion millions of times more powerful than that of a equivalent amount of a chemical explosive like TNT is created. And we've just forgotten the extraordinary destructive force of this technology. The bomb that destroyed Hiroshima was a remarkably crude, rudimentary nuclear weapon.
This great story of the test before that, how the tests weren't really going off and they would have someone essentially run up on a ladder and light a candle almost.
Well, you know, they weren't really sure if it would work when they were testing the first nuclear device in the desert of New Mexico. And there was a wide discrepancy in what they thought the yield would be of that explosion. There was even a concern that the atmosphere might catch on fire. And they did calculations for a year at Los Alamos just to make sure that all of life would not be extinguished.
By the test.
By the test. And they weren't really sure until they set off that nuclear device. And in the book, I write about a physicist, Victor Weisskopf, who had been doing a lot of these calculations for a year to see if the atmosphere would catch on fire. And he was standing 10 miles away from this test. And when he saw the size of the fireball and he felt intense heat on his face at a distance of 10 miles, he really believed that all life on Earth was about to be extinguished. Thankfully, he was wrong, but this sense of the technology just on the verge of being out of our control has been present, I would argue, from that day in July of 1945 to the present day. These are very complicated machines. They're very dangerous machines. They're connected to other machines, communication networks, et cetera. And we've come close again and again to having them catastrophically go wrong.
Talk to me, let's get a little geeked out here, just about sort of what happens at the physical level, what's connecting to what, creating what kind of reaction to generate that heat?
Yeah, well, you know, it's different from a chemical reaction. This is a nuclear chain reaction. And what's happening is that atoms are being, in an atomic bomb, atoms are being split. And the splitting of an atom releases energy. And in creating a chain reaction, lots of atoms are split. And as I said about this, to give a sense of the power of it, the Hiroshima bomb was an incredibly inefficient, rudimentary nuclear weapon. It was the first one used as a weapon. It contained about 144 pounds of bomb-grade uranium, and most of that never even underwent a nuclear chain reaction. It just got blown harmlessly into the air. Only about 2 pounds of bomb-grade uranium underwent this process of nuclear fission, and most of that just turned into other radioactive elements. So when you think of the explosion that was created, that explosion was created by about 7/10 of a gram of bomb-grade uranium. 7/10 of a gram is about the size of a peppercorn.
And that was not the intent. The intent was to have it all go off.
Well, they wanted a lot of it to go off, but in this case, just having something the size of a peppercorn turn into pure energy killed 80,000 people and destroyed 2/3 of the buildings in a major metropolitan area in an instant. So this is unbelievably destructive force. And within a decade of the detonation of that Hiroshima bomb, we had thermonuclear weapons, which relied on fission, the splitting of the atom, but also fusion, the combining of hydrogen atoms. And we did a test of a hydrogen bomb that was 1,000 times more powerful than that Hiroshima bomb. And this one weapon, it was used in what was known as the Bravo test in the South Seas. It was so powerful that if one of those weapons had been dropped on Washington, D.C., we're talking about one nuclear weapon, the radioactive fallout from that one weapon would kill everybody in Washington, everybody in Baltimore, everybody in Philadelphia, and half the population of New York City. One of these weapons. And eventually, during the Cold War, the United States had 32,000 nuclear weapons, not all of them as powerful as that one. But as a culture, we have forgotten the extraordinary destructive force of just one of these things. And it's a highly relevant issue today because there are between 16 and 17,000 nuclear weapons in the world. And every one of those weapons is a potential source of mass murder and destruction, the likes of which we haven't seen in 70 years.
Which is why your book is so funny. But there's a level, the way you wrote the book is the stories of the things that have happened over the course of the last 70 years.
Yeah.
Some of them are tragically, comically, incredibly funny or just unbelievable. Talk to me, there's a little community which would have been forgotten, called Mars Bluff, South Carolina. And something happened there, and it's about 300 miles. It's really kind of right between Atlanta and D.C. It's about 300 miles from Atlanta, 400 miles from Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
What happened there?
What happened there was a bomber took off with an atomic bomb. And
as they are in the air right now, right?
I mean, they're not in the air right now, but they were routinely in the Cold War. And there was a light in the cockpit that showed that when they would take off, the bomb wouldn't be fully locked in because the pilot wanted the possibility of jettisoning the bomb over water if they had to make an emergency landing or something like that. So a light went off in the cockpit that showed the bomb wasn't properly locked in, and they had to lock it in to fly over the United States. So the pilot asked one of the crew members to go into the bomb bay and make sure that the bomb was properly locked in. And the crew member wasn't excited about this because the bomb bay wasn't pressurized. It wasn't someplace you normally went into a flight. And he wasn't quite sure how to lock in the bomb, even if he got there. He'd never had to lock one in midair. So the crew member climbs back into the bomb bay. He's searching for the locking pin. It's over this big bomb. He's reaching above the bomb.
How big is the bomb?
It's big. It's probably, 12? 14 feet, big, wide bomb.
So it's like the bigger than a refrigerator.
It's bigger than a refrigerator. It's a big bomb. He's looking for the locking pin, and he gets jostled, and he grabs onto something. He grabs onto a strap, and it's the manual bomb release mechanism. So as he's in the bomb bay doors basically are right there. The bomb falls onto the bomb bay doors. He falls onto the bomb, and then he grabs onto something in the bomb bay as the doors break, and he's suddenly looking down, whatever, 10,000 feet, as this bomb is just falling down towards Mars Bluff. Now, fortunately, this was not a fully assembled atomic bomb. It didn't have the nuclear core in it, but it had a lot of high explosives, and when it landed, it exploded in somebody's yard. And somebody was just, you know, in the yard working when an atomic bomb fell out of the sky and exploded and shattered the windows, destroyed the car, killed the chickens. And it got a lot of attention in the media, but it actually, of all of our nuclear weapons accidents, it could have killed this poor family, but the bomb was not fully assembled. We had other fully assembled nuclear weapons that, through equally bizarre circumstances, were involved in accidents. Now, I do think that Stanley Kubrick was aware of this accident, because in the film Dr. Strangelove, there's a scene where they're trying to drop a hydrogen bomb and it won't fall out of the plane, and one of the, you know, the pilot of the plane jumps on the bomb to try to get the bomb bay doors to open up, and then winds up riding the bomb down, you know, like he's riding a bucking bronco in a rodeo. But this was there were two nuclear weapons accidents in which a crew member in the bomb bay, for various reasons, inadvertently pulled on the manual bomb release and dropped a bomb. A bomb was dropped on Albuquerque, New Mexico, much the same way. It didn't detonate, but once again, there was a crew member in the bomb bay having to look down at thousands, you know, the earth thousands of feet below as a bomb is just falling down. Human beings involved, crazy sorts of mistakes can happen. The problem with mistakes with thermonuclear weapons is, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people can be hurt when you make one of these inadvertent mistakes.
Well, let's talk about that cowboy metaphor is important for a couple reasons. The stewardship of the nuclear program in this country has gone through a handful of dramatic changes that have a lot of philosophy behind them. Can you talk to me about that evolution? Initially, it was civilian control.
Yeah. Originally, there was civilian control. And increasingly, once the Soviet Union had nuclear weapons, there was a very strong desire by the military to have these weapons so that the military, you know, could use them immediately if we were under attack. And one of the big philosophical struggles from the very beginning of our nuclear arsenal is the military desire to always have weapons available for immediate use and for those weapons to always work when you use them. Because the military didn't want to have to, the Air Force didn't want to fly a bomber all the way to the Soviet Union, pilots, crew members risking their lives, and drop a bomb and realize it doesn't work. It's a dud.
And so similarly, they didn't want to have to ask for permission again, right? There were sort of levels of permission that they didn't, hoops they didn't want to jump through.
Right. So the military wants these weapons to be always available, always work. And during peacetime, a lot of the civilians in the Department of Defense and at the White House wanted to make sure that these weapons would never explode accidentally, that these weapons could never be sabotaged or never used by someone without permission of the President of the United States, never be stolen. So you had this philosophical difference between always and never, dating back to the early years of the Cold War, and again I show in the book how the preference was made for always, and the management decisions, you know, were made to emphasize the always, and that led to nuclear weapons that were much less safe than they could have been, and nuclear weapons that could have been used by personnel without permission, you know, of the President of the United States. It wasn't until the early 1970s that there were mechanical locks on the bombs to prevent air crews or launch crews from using their weapons. People, you know, when Dr. Strangelove came out, it was strongly attacked by the Pentagon as being completely unrealistic, because the plot of the film was about an Air Force general who deliberately wants to start World War III. The reality was, until the early 1970s, there was nothing to prevent an American bomber crew with their nuclear weapons to fly to the Soviet Union and just drop them or even drop them on Chicago or drop them on an American city. The only thing that prevented that crew from doing it was their professionalism and military discipline. There was nothing to prevent a launch crew in an underground control center from turning their keys and launching their missiles
on their ex-wives, let alone
aiming wherever they wanted to aim at. And so much of this was deliberately kept from the American people during the Cold War in order to maintain popular support for our nuclear arsenal. And it's only now that this information is we're able to reveal it.
Yeah, we were talking before, but the footnoting in your book is, I loved the book, and I would occasionally go to the footnotes, but I took the time to go through all the footnotes before we were going to talk today, and let me sort of relive the book. But it's a fairly amazing set of footnotes that was surely torture to assemble. Talk to me, I'm skipping ahead, about your philosophy on the footnoting of the book and why. There were a lot of things that I don't think required as much footnoting as you chose to put in.
A lot of the information in the book is unbelievable, and yet it's true. And so I felt that I was obligated to show where this information came from. So much of this has been kept, as I said, from public awareness. So the footnotes are there to show you where it came from. And the footnotes are there also to help other people who might want to write about this subject in the future. My book, Fast Food Nation, was heavily footnoted in the same way, and I think it helped other writers who wanted to write about food, readers who wanted more information on the subject, and also because there was so much secrecy and continues to be so much secrecy around nuclear weapons, just philosophically, I wanted my work to be transparent. And there's almost nothing in the book that is based on unnamed sources. It's based on interviews, documents that I obtained, documents that came through the Freedom of Information Act, and other people can look at them as well. And again, so many of the stories in the book seem incredible on the surface, but are true.
Among those things are the sort of odd cameos that pop up in your book, including the important character of Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah.
Talk to me about Jimmy Stewart's role in the growth of the nuclear arsenal.
Jimmy Stewart was a deeply patriotic man, and when it looked like World War II was going to break out, he tried to enlist. He was a pilot. He wanted to be in the Army Air Force, and he couldn't enlist because he didn't meet the weight standard. So he put on some weight. He tried to enlist again, and he got into the Army Air Force. And he never spoke about it, he never wrote about it, but he was involved in some of the most dangerous bombing missions of the Second World War. There were actors like John Wayne and Ronald Reagan who never saw duty, who never risked their lives. And then there were others like Jimmy Stewart who, went on dozens of extremely dangerous missions. After the war,
statistics on how many survived those missions.
Yeah,
what was the average?
If you were a member of a bomber crew in the Second World War in the European campaign, I think the odds were 1 in 5 that you would never return. It was much more dangerous than being an infantryman in the Second World War. And he later was so proud of the Air Force that he made a film called Strategic Air Command, which was about our bombers that were going to go to war with the Soviet Union. It was a very patriotic film. He became close with Curtis LeMay, who was the head of the Strategic Air Command, and Jimmy Stewart wound up being a very high-level reserve officer in the Strategic Air Command, and it's incredible, but if we had gone to nuclear war, he might have been called up and been in the headquarters of the Strategic Air Command for it. So in writing about Jimmy Stewart, I was writing about a particular moment in the 1950s when the Strategic Air Command and our nuclear forces were considered the most elite unit in the American military. And they were in charge of the most powerful weapons, and they had this commander, Curtis LeMay, who was a legendary officer. And in writing about that period, it allows me to write about the decline in morale, the decline in competence. So that, I'm writing about the mid-1950s when Jimmy Stewart is sort of, praising the virtues of the Strategic Air Command. By the mid-1970s, you have extremely poor morale in the Air Force. It's the post-Vietnam War era military. There's extraordinary anti-military sentiment throughout much of American society. And you have, you know, illegal drug use in the Strategic Air Command. You have people with nuclear weapons responsibilities who are using marijuana, cocaine, even LSD, which is quite a remarkable thing. In that book that you mentioned, Reefer Madness, you know, I write about how our marijuana laws are too punitive, and I support the decriminalization of marijuana. I don't think anyone should go to prison for marijuana, but I don't think anyone who has control over nuclear weapons should be smoking pot. And that might be a radical view, but it's amazing how much illegal drug use there was in the Air Force and in the Navy among people who had nuclear weapons responsibilities. Once widespread mandatory drug testing was instituted in the military in the early 1980s, the rates of drug use plummeted. But I was surprised this year that some of our Minuteman missile launch officers were caught using illegal drugs. And I thought that that problem had been eliminated. And it's a sign of poor morale. It's a sign of poor management. And I thought that that problem had been dealt with, and clearly it hasn't been.
In reading in your book, I could hear the sounds of Lynyrd Skynyrd or the Allman Brothers in 1980 in Damascus, Arkansas. Tell me about the story that connects a lot of the parts of your book, connects the past to the present, is, you know, who thinks that of 1980 is the connective tissue of any era, or let alone all these great eras. What happened in Damascus?
Damascus, Arkansas is a small town in the foothills of the Ozarks. And from the early 1960s through the 1980s, Arkansas was the host to some of our most powerful nuclear weapons. And in Damascus, Arkansas, there was a Titan II missile silo. The Titan II was the biggest intercontinental ballistic missile the United States ever built. And on top of it was the most powerful nuclear warhead the United States ever built. That one warhead in that silo in Damascus, Arkansas, had three times the explosive force of all the bombs used by all the militaries in World War II combined, including both atomic bombs. This was an extraordinarily powerful nuclear weapon. And on September 18th, 1980, in Damascus, Arkansas, there was a maintenance crew doing routine maintenance in the silo, doing the kind of repair work they did all the time without thinking about it. And they were one of the workers were standing on a steel work platform near the top of this big missile.
How big is that? I can't recall.
Pardon me?
How tall are they? This
the Titan II is about 103 feet tall, right. So about the size of a 10-story building. And they were working on the steel work platform, about to unscrew a pressure cap, the kind of thing they did all the time. And the socket fell off of the handle.
The socket wrench.
Of the socket wrench. And it hit the steel work platform, bounced. The worker grabbed for it, missed it, and it fell in a very narrow gap in between the platform and the missile. It dropped about 80 feet, hit the concrete silo wall, ricocheted, and hit the missile. And when it hit the missile, it pierced a hole in its metal skin. And suddenly, there were...
In part because it was like super pressurized, right? So it was actually very fragile, even though it was metal skin.
This missile was supposed to fly, you know, thousands of miles, and so it had to be as light as possible. And it pierced the skin, and suddenly thousands of gallons of highly explosive rocket fuel are filling the silo with this unbelievably powerful nuclear warhead on top of it, of the missile. And the Air Force had this missile on alert 24 hours a day, 17 years, and nothing like this had ever happened before. The Air Force had no idea what to do. And the reason that Lynyrd Skynyrd and this sort of rock and roll is relevant is that this was an obsolete weapon system. It should have been taken out of commission years earlier. There were shortages of spare parts. In many ways, it was an accident waiting to happen. And then the accident happened. And by telling the story of this one nuclear weapons accident in minute-by-minute detail, it allows me to go off on all kinds of digressions about this technology. And what the book is ultimately about is the challenge of managing complex technological systems. Apple just came out with the new iPhone.
I was going to use this line.
And well, I mean,
we were talking on the phone last
and,
week.
And they
this.
Put so much time and energy into figuring out the new operating system for the iPhone, and within a day, they realized that phones were shutting down and the operating system didn't work. Now, the consequences of glitches in that operating system are, some people are inconvenienced by not being able to use their phone.
I got at least 3 days out of TV on it.
Well, I mean, the consequences of a mistake in a nuclear weapons system can be catastrophic. And one of the themes of the book is that we're much better at creating complex technological systems than we are in managing them, let alone in knowing what to do about them when something goes wrong. And it was a desperate effort by the Air Force to save this missile, to prevent it from exploding, and prevent losing control of this awesomely deadly nuclear warhead on top of it. And again, in the book, I go through instances in which seemingly simple events, like dropping a socket, in Mars Bluff, a guy pulling the wrong handle. We had an accident at a Minuteman missile silo in which there was a problem with the intruder alarm, the burglar alarm. So they sent a maintenance guy out there to fix the burglar alarm. He opens up the fuse box. He starts pulling different fuses to see what's wrong with the burglar alarm. But he used a screwdriver instead of a fuse puller. So he pulled one, nothing happened. Pulled another, nothing happened. Pulled another, and there was a loud explosion. And he'd created a short circuit that blasted the warhead off of the top of the missile. And it fell all the way to the bottom of the silo. It did not detonate. But you would not want to do that 15 times to see if it would detonate. So it's very often very minor, trivial mistakes that can be catastrophic. And this applies to nuclear power as well as nuclear weapons. Chernobyl is acknowledged as the worst nuclear reactor accident that's ever occurred. And the meltdown at Chernobyl began because they decided to do a safety drill. And in the midst of the safety drill, they turned off the safety mechanisms of the reactor and caused a meltdown. Now, you wouldn't think that the worst nuclear disaster with nuclear power of all would occur during a drill, but human error and interactions with complex technology can lead to all kinds of bad things.
I was telling some of the soccer dads on Friday night about talking to you about your book, and they hadn't read it yet, so you have a couple sales left to happen.
Yeah.
There was sort of resounding, well, these guys are like problems fixers. These are guys who, that's what they do in their jobs, and they, well, surely the Air Force is learning from these things. These things might have happened in the 50s or in 1980, but they're learning from it. And in the notes of your book, you give a lot of credit to the Damascus report that you found, the report of missile accident investigation, major missile incident accident, 19 September 1980. And then you say, when I contacted the Air Force for a copy of this report, I was told the Air Force no longer possessed one.
Yeah.
So the lessons from these accidents, rather than being part of the lore of the people who are managing these facilities, instead, is just not only is it kept from the public, according to your book, it's kept from the Air Force.
According to the Air Force, they have no copies of this accident report, and I was able to find it because Congressman Dan Glickman of Kansas was very interested in this accident, and got hold of this report, and then donated it with his congressional papers to the University of Wichita, and there was a copy of this report there. It's amazing how the mistakes are repeated and repeated again. And I talked about how the post-Vietnam War era military had such low morale and illegal drug use and disrespect for people in the military. And unfortunately, the post-Iraq War military, post-Afghanistan War military, is suffering many of the same problems, shortages of spare parts, aging equipment. 60 Minutes did an investigative piece this year in problems with our nuclear arsenal. They went into the underground control centers for our missiles. They found doors that wouldn't close, telephones that wouldn't work. The computers in our launch control centers, 30 years old, still relying on 8-inch floppy disks. And the nuclear weapons that we have today, I think, are much safer than the ones I wrote about in my book. But the weapons systems are aging, these missiles. Our principal nuclear bomber is the B-52, which was designed in the late 1940s, built in the 50s. We haven't built a B-52 since John F. Kennedy was president. And the thing that concerns me the most today, again, talking about complex technological systems, are the wiring, the cables, the computers that are all interconnected. And a mistake with one of those could be catastrophic. We lost control of 50 Minuteman missiles for almost an hour in 2010. What that means is the launch control centers could no longer communicate to their missiles. And the Air Force denied at the time that anyone had hacked into our nuclear command and control system, but privately became quite worried about that possibility. And so there is genuine reason for concern about insiders in this system, in the same way that Snowden was able to mess around with the NSA and gain access to all kinds of files that he was never supposed to be able to get near. The NSA is responsible for the launch codes of our missiles. The NSA is responsible for the cryptographic equipment that decodes those launch codes. And there is margin for somebody or other, a number of people within the system to monkey around with these weapons.
And you talk about how there are pockets of some of the older technologies still around. It's not like we get a new technology, get rid of the old one, and there are lots of sort of people campaigning to keep those things for political and other reasons. Do you remember the story of the Snark missile? It's brief in your book.
Yeah.
It was a Snark missile that was tested at Cape Canaveral.
Yeah. It was tested at Cape Canaveral, and then it just kept on going. And this was an early version of a cruise missile, and it just kept on going.
You said it could only go as far as Puerto Rico.
It went way past Puerto Rico, and I think it was the jungles of Venezuela where it disappeared. The book tries to be even-handed and factual. It's not a polemic. It's not a diatribe. I tried very hard for there not to be good guys and bad guys, except for the Soviet Union, which was full of people doing terrible things. But in terms of our military, there were extraordinarily intelligent, well-intended people trying to protect this country, but creating systems too complicated for any one person to understand, and systems that even with the best of intentions were constantly on the verge of spiraling out of control.
I'm going to start to take some of the questions, and if you think of more questions, please do send them up here, right on the blue cards you have with you. This is a question from Joel Gersten, and he talks about, I'm going to paraphrase, you'll pardon me for that, about speaking about the relative safety and security of the Russian nuclear arsenal today.
It's hard to know. One of the problems with the Russian arsenal is that in addition to the strategic weapons, which are weapons that are meant to be used generally over long distances, they'd be, warheads on missiles, the Russians have 1,000, maybe 4,000 tactical nuclear weapons, which are supposed to be embedded with the military forces, are usually used closer to the front lines, and those weapons may be more liable to being stolen. I think the Russians have done a good job since the end of the Cold War of locking down their weapons. It's remarkable how loosely guarded they were when the Soviet Union collapsed. But it's hard to know, and it's even harder to know what Pakistan or India are doing with their nuclear weapons, how they're being stored, how they're being maintained. And, I think, without being too patriotic, I think we invented this technology, we perfected it. I think we probably build the safest nuclear weapons and have the most advanced security technology. And if we've come this close again and again to having catastrophic accidents with our own weapons, it makes me concerned about Russia and Pakistan and India that aren't as technologically proficient.
The relationships aren't the same between, there was a sort of, the experience of going to Red Alert was one that happened throughout the Cold War. And those officers, as they rose through the ranks, had that experience.
Yeah.
They knew something about their counterparts and had some regular dealings with them.
Yeah.
The same was true on the other side. I mean, the Putin, as we see the Ukraine, has been very unpredictable to the U.S. military, some of whom are responsible for looking across the horizon and deciding what the next light coming across the horizon is.
Yeah. I mean, there are some people who think that the current situation in Europe may be more dangerous than at times during the Cold War because there is not the same sort of familiarity. And, you know, the people who are running our nuclear arsenal and running Russia's haven't had to go on levels of very heightened alert. The people who were in command during the Cold War, a great many of them were World War II veterans. They'd seen battle, and then they'd been through a series of crises over Hungary, over Berlin, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and had to function with nuclear forces at a heightened level of alert. And we haven't had a crisis like that, thankfully, since the mid-1980s, but it means the officers in charge today haven't had to command their forces when there is a possibility of using nuclear weapons. And that's when serious mistakes and accidents are more likely to occur.
And indeed, one of the things your book brings to light is that the information coming in might indicate everything that there's a nuclear war has been launched. And on a couple of occasions, people have just had to say, no, I don't believe it this time.
Yeah. I mean, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was President Carter's national security advisor, was awakened at 2 in the morning by his military aide, who said the United States is under attack, and there may be, I think the number was 220 Soviet missiles on their way, and Brzezinski said, I want you to check that out and make sure that's accurate. And the military aide called back and said, sir, it's actually, I think, 2,200 missiles on their way. And Brzezinski got ready to contact President Carter to talk about the retaliation. Brzezinski thought about whether to wake up his wife or not. She was asleep in bed next to him. He decided to let her sleep. And if Washington was about to be destroyed, he wanted her to die in her sleep. And the phone rang again. And it was his military aide, General William Odom, who said, I'm sorry, sir. It was a false alarm. And it was later traced back to a 15-cent computer chip that had failed and was generating false missiles. And, you know, today, particularly between India and Pakistan, there isn't that time to determine if it's a false alarm or not. If a missile was launched from the Soviet Union to the United States, it would take about a half hour to land. If the missiles were launched from a submarine off the coast, it would take 10, 15 minutes. That still gave you, if you were a commander in the United States, time to determine, is that a real missile launch or is that a false alarm? Between India and Pakistan, the flight time of a missile might be 5, 6 minutes. So in a nuclear war, the dynamic is very similar to that of a shootout in the Old West. Whoever fires first is more likely to win, and if you don't use your weapons immediately, you might never be able to use them. So it's a very dangerous situation today between India and Pakistan, a very potentially unstable situation.
So President Obama ran in part in a campaign of disarmament, nuclear disarmament, and talked about it quite a bit. There's an amazing piece in the New York Times recently, and a quote of the Monterey Institute, and it had this graphic that showed the spending of every president of every administration since the 1950s. And President Obama last year spent $10 billion, more than any president since the 1950s in any given year, on the nuclear arsenal. There's the suggestion that it's about modernization.
Yeah.
But your book makes clear that's always been the description of every new nuclear arms project has been about modernization.
Yeah. Well, I'll defend the president. The president wanted to get an arms control agreement that he had signed with Russia passed the Senate. And it was a very, very narrow margin. And he made an agreement in return for getting passage of the arms control agreement that he would spend money on modernizing our nuclear infrastructure. And the New York Times article was about what the future costs of that will be. But that modernization...
Which you put up over...
$1 trillion over 30 years. But that modernization has by no means been locked into place. And I would bet the president made that agreement knowing that this spending either is never going to occur or that we're going to have a major national debate over this spending And I think it's essential we have a debate. I mean, all three legs of what is called, of what are called the nuclear triad, our missiles, our bombers, and our submarines, are aging and are going to have to be replaced. And we need a debate in this country about how many nuclear weapons do we need? Do we need any? What kind? What are they going to be used for? And this sort of future spending is going to really require that sort of national debate. So I think it was a very good New York Times article to bring attention to, you know, how much money we may have to spend. But I think it also was misleading in the sense that we haven't gone down that road yet. We're not committed to doing it. And I think President Obama was put into a corner of wanting to get this arms control treaty signed and having to make certain promises that maybe long term he doesn't want to have to keep.
I will tweet out that article for those watching or those listening to the radio at Corey TV on Twitter. I'll retweet that. But that ties into some of the questions. Let me get to some of these. Patrick Tobin asks, again, I'm paraphrasing, combining the two questions, is your recommendation to the U.S. government pursuing unilateral disarmament?
Yeah. The book that I wrote really doesn't include any policy recommendations at all. The book that I wrote is a calm, factual account of the difficulties of managing our nuclear arsenal. My own personal views are I support the abolition of nuclear weapons. The first resolution of the United Nations was calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. Presidents from Harry Truman through Eisenhower, Kennedy, Carter, Reagan, and now President Obama have called for the abolition of nuclear weapons. But I personally do not support unilateral disarmament. And I think that we need meaningful arms reduction between the United States and Russia, who control 90% of the world's nuclear weapons. But I think China is going to have to be transparent about its arsenal. Right now, nobody knows how many nuclear weapons China has. Pakistan has the fastest growing arsenal in the world. India, all the nuclear powers are going to have to come to the table and work together to reduce the number of nuclear weapons and then hopefully one day eliminate all of them. So I don't believe in unilateral disarmament.
It's a great question here because your book, you know, talks about sort of the human fallibility that's just never going to go away with all the systems that can be designed. But the question here, are you more or equally concerned about a nuclear weapon going off by accident or intentionally?
Right now, I'm more concerned about a nuclear weapon being detonated intentionally. I think that
by
either terrorists who have fabricated a weapon, you know, having stolen bomb-grade uranium and plutonium, or a nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan. I think that a nuclear accident and an accidental detonation is still a real risk, but right now I'm more concerned about people deliberately using nuclear weapons. What you see in the Middle East right now is extraordinary. We are seeing the deliberate slaughter of civilians. It's not just deliberate, it's boastful. The proud videotaping of the slaughter of civilians, the proud destruction of historical monuments, of mosques, of churches, and those groups that are conducting that level of violence, if they had access to nuclear weapons, I think would use them. And so I'm concerned about the risk of nuclear terrorism and the risk of nuclear armed states using their weapons.
How long does weapons-grade uranium, this is a question from Martin Shields, how long does weapon-grade uranium remain usable for weapon before it needs to be replaced?
Well, you know, we have found that the plutonium pits, the plutonium cores of our nuclear weapons are good at least for 90 years. I mean, there are other parts of the weapons that have to be replaced more often than that, but these nuclear cores are good for a very long time.
You know, in your book, you talk a little bit about sort of the proliferation, and not a lot, but a little bit. There's this notion that we should be able to tell other countries, the other countries like Iran certainly raise, that we should be able to tell them what to do, and that the United Nations should be able to tell them what to do. Is there a hypocritical aspect of that?
I don't think there is at all. Iran signed a treaty, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, And when they signed it, they were given access to nuclear technology for peaceful uses of nuclear power. And they promised not to create nuclear weapons. And the evidence is very strong to me that they've had a nuclear weapons program. So they, I think, have been in violation of that treaty. And the nuclear weapons states that signed that treaty, the five nuclear weapons states that are allowed to have nuclear weapons under that treaty, are supposed to be working diligently to reducing the number of weapons in their arsenal. Now, I'm very critical of our government, but at the height of our arsenal, we had 32,000 nuclear weapons. Today, we have 4,800. So that's a reduction of 27,000, and we need to keep on going lower and lower. So we have, you know, perhaps not fully obeyed our promises under that treaty. I am a strong believer that no other nations in the world should obtain nuclear weapons. There are academics who have argued that the more countries obtain nuclear weapons, the less likely there is to be a nuclear war. And I think that's true until it isn't true. I really believe the more weapons there are in the world, the more countries have these weapons, the more likely it is they'll be used. So I see no hypocrisy whatsoever in the fact that the United States has nuclear weapons and the United States is eager to prevent other countries from having them.
There's, in this era of Edward Snowden and so on, there have also been a lot of changes in the way the U.S. military works, the way it's staffed, and who works for the U.S. military. I was struck by I was in an airport right when the Snowden story was starting to break, and I was reading the LA Times, and it was something on a jump, and it was a quote from a guy in the NSA saying, it was on the record, and he said, look, we have really strong systems protecting this kind of thing from happening. When some guy is looking up something on his ex-wife, they get in a lot of trouble for that. And I read that and thought, wait a minute, they can go look up stuff about their ex-wife? They're admitting the problem right there. When you and I talked last week, I just come back from a walk with a software CEO who told me their policy at his company was never to hire a software engineer for less than $100,000 right out of college, because everyone at Facebook and Google is getting paid at least that, and Apple's getting paid something near that, but they just want to work at Apple. How can the U.S. government, when they're contracting a lot of the security stuff and they're unable to pay the competitive salaries that, you know, the greatest minds in science went to work on the Manhattan Project. The greatest minds in science right now, when they graduate from MIT and Carnegie Mellon and Stanford, sorry, Stanford and Berkeley, I meant to say, are going to work for Goldman Sachs and for Facebook and for Apple.
Yeah. Well, that's a reflection of the culture that we have today. And, you know, one of the themes of my book is the incredible service that our military personnel performed during the Cold War. And it sounds really corny, but, you know, young men who lost their lives, risked their lives trying to prevent nuclear catastrophes, trying to prevent nuclear war. And in today's military, there are a great many people who are motivated by things other than money. So I don't want to, you know, diminish or put down at all the caliber of the people in the military today or the caliber of the people at the weapons labs. But there's no question that there are a lot of people in Silicon Valley who are being motivated not by national service and could maybe be using their skills to solve some of these really difficult nuclear weapons issues. I mean, we really need the best and the brightest focusing on how do we prevent this technology from being used? How do we prevent other countries from getting nuclear weapons? How do we develop controls on the weapons that we have now that are as safe and secure as possible? And again, a lot of it is the network. I mean, if you want to have the ability of the President of the United States to give an order and have thousands of nuclear weapons at disparate locations all over the world suddenly activated, you have to create a communications network and a system. And as long as you have that network and that system, it's vulnerable to someone else getting into it and using some of these weapons. And it's a real challenge. So we really do need the best and the brightest minds involved. And if you're working at one of the weapons labs today, you're not going to be making as much as an engineer as you would at Silicon Valley. Maybe you would after you leave the weapons lab, but this subject could not be more important and really needs the attention of the best and the brightest that we have. You mentioned Snowden. It's quite remarkable. I mean, Edward Snowden was a low-level private contractor who was able to get access to the top secrets of the most top-secret intelligence agency that we have. And I have no doubt that information that Snowden obtained is information the President of the United States was completely unaware of, about. And that concerns me greatly in the vulnerabilities in our nuclear command and control system, potentially, or the nuclear command and control systems of other countries like Russia or China or Pakistan or India that are, similarly have networks that could be conceivably disrupted or hacked into, and bad things could happen.
I'm going to get back to some of the questions in the cards here, and thank you, everyone, for those. Please send more if you got them. Can you discuss the initiatives of the Carter administration and how they've been thwarted over the last 34 years? President Clinton, or Bill Clinton, I should say, Governor Clinton, has it seems like is in your book as much as Carter.
Yeah, the initiatives of the Carter administration.
Carter administration, yeah.
Well, the Carter administration was interesting in that Jimmy Carter took office talking about abolishing nuclear weapons. And then Jimmy Carter was responsible for a major, major nuclear arms buildup and modernization. And what happened to change his nuclear policies was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and a rekindling of the Cold War. So I don't think there may be an effort to equate President Obama's policies and his change with that of Carter. And I don't think the analogy is apt right now, because we haven't gone far enough down that road of rebuilding our arsenal in the way that that Carter really set the wheels into motion.
A few more questions on the cards here. What do you think is the biggest potential for technological error in our arsenal?
I think the biggest potential for technological error is the communications network. I think that some sort of glitch giving an incorrect command.
Just what you're talking about with Brzezinski?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Or with a launch order being generated, either mistakenly or by someone deliberately hacking into the system.
And one of the arguments that one of the soccer dads put up to me was that there were so many great advances in the rest of technology that came out of the weapons research and systems that we should have more of that to get those benefits.
That we should have more weapons.
More development of weapon systems because of the side benefits of technological advancement have been so great.
What we really should have is more government financing of basic science and technology. And it just so happened that the science and technology that the government was financing through the Cold War was through the military. But, you know, the civilian space program came up with all sorts of technologies that were then adopted as well. And but it is true that, you know, the nuclear command and control system and the development of nuclear weapons was responsible for advances in high-speed computing, computer networks, the miniaturization of circuitry, et cetera, et cetera. But it's because the government was pouring multiple billions of dollars into research and technology.
Throw something in with something else. A stopped clock is right twice a day. It's a Wall Street expression
yeah.
that I happen to love. Similar question on the other side of the coin. What do you think we should do, or what is the biggest human risk in the nuclear system?
I think that the human risk in the nuclear system is the insider threat, that there are people within the system who, for ideological reasons or financial reasons, would allow the theft of a weapon or would allow the theft of bomb-grade fissile material, bomb-grade uranium or plutonium. And that's a very, very difficult thing to police. There could be people, insiders, with access to stuff or information that could be very dangerous.
What's the reaction been to the book? I mean, you were a finalist for the Pulitzer. It's a fun read, and presumably sold pretty well. It's got some great reviews, but what kind of reactions have you gotten from this book, and how has it been different than your other books?
It's the first book that I've written that didn't cause pushback by the groups that I wrote about and criticized. You know, when I wrote about the fast food industry and I wrote about the meatpacking industry, my work was attacked and I was attacked, and I haven't felt that at all. As a matter of fact, I've felt within the weapons community a sense that they're glad these stories have been told. I've found, you know, from the Cold War veterans, a feeling that their service has been acknowledged. You know, I'm very glad for that, but then there's part of me that hates knowing this stuff is true. I mean, I tried very hard to fact check it and make it as accurate as possible, but it wasn't until it was published and out in the world that I realized this really is true. And that's quite unnerving, because again and again, we came close to catastrophe during the Cold War. And as a new Cold War seems to be settling onto the world, you know, we don't want that sort of nuclear standoff again with Russia. We barely survived the last Cold War without losing cities, and we don't want to have another Cold War.
Combining a couple of questions, but someone from Twitter, Anna Akita, I think I have the name right, talks about how can we create a stronger public opinion. In some of these questions, how can we help people remember what happened in Hiroshima, what happened in Nagasaki, which we haven't mentioned up here.
Yeah.
What do we do?
Well, I've done what I can do. I mean, I've written a book, and that is my way of beginning the process of awareness. This gathering this evening that's going to be on the radio is another part of it. And I found, you know, after writing Fast Food Nation, that movements begin and awareness doesn't occur because of one person or one book. Things begin to snowball and gain momentum. The 70th anniversary of the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is this coming summer, and that will provide the occasion for debate. I think the enormous bill that the American people may be presented with for modernizing the arsenal is going to be an opportunity for debating these issues. Hopefully, Iran will agree to end its weapons program. And, you know, so there are all kinds of things that can spark this discussion. But what I hope is that the awareness grows and people realize they're not powerless in this system, and that their voices can be heard. Their voices can be heard with their elected officials. You know, we just had a climate change march in New York City that attracted a few hundred thousand people. A lot of Americans forget, but the biggest political demonstration in American history occurred in 1982. It was in Central Park. 750,000 to 1 million people demonstrated against nuclear weapons. And so this is a knowledge and a threat that's been largely forgotten, but I think we need to remember it, we need to confront it, and then greatly reduce it. If I felt like we were doomed, if I felt like there was no hope, I really would not have bothered spending 6 years writing this book. I feel like this is a problem that can be largely solved, and this is a threat that can be greatly diminished, but the first step is for people to know about it.
I have a lot more questions, but I can't end on a better note, so I want to thank Eric Schlosser. Excellent discussion. World Affairs Council thanks you as well for your book, Command and Control, and the discussion of that. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you.